Welcome to Red Alert Radio, grassroots radio with an ear on the issues that matter to you.
Kia ora koutou. Welcome everybody to this edition of Red Alert. My name's Christine O'Brien from the Māngere o Tāhuhu Local Board, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to this edition. Now, it's Volunteer Week this week, and first of all, I'd just like to make a huge shout out to all the wonderful volunteers out there in our community. It's incredible what you do for your families, for your clubs, your churches, and your communities generally, and we really appreciate all those hard yards and unpaid yards, I have to say. In South Auckland, we are blessed with great community spirit, and many people are contributing in many, many ways. I think recent things we've seen are these huge growth in community pantries, for example, free meals in local town halls, street cleanups, and many, many expressions of caring and support. But this does tend to get a bit lost in the media profile of South Auckland. And at the moment, people outside our area mainly know South Auckland as a place of apparently growing unrest, concern once again about youth issues, and this includes gang activity and general community safety. So it's true to say there have been a number of shootings in the Māngere o Tāhuhu area in this year, mostly isolated incidents as far as we're aware, and sadly several involving young men much loved by their families. There have also been a number of different incidents in Ōtara over the last year or so, and this has given rise to some of these concerns about community safety and youth wellbeing. My guest today is Harry Whatutoliafua, and he has a community support role at the Māngere Community Law Centre, but he's also involved with several significant networks in South Auckland which deal with youth or which support frontline service providers and workers out there. So welcome, Harry.
Christine, and thank you for having me on our show. Also, greetings to our listeners, and like you touched on at the beginning of the show, just want to make special acknowledgement to the various volunteers who may or may not be listening at the moment, given that they're true unsung heroes, but I just thought I'd make special mention of that.
Oh, malo, malo. So, Harry, you and I both know South Auckland as a place of enormous warmth and community spirit, and also you're in a unique position, I think, to grapple with the perceptions of South Auckland and the realities of South Auckland through your work with the Community Law Centre. Firstly, I wonder just a little bit about you. So how did you come to be drawn into this kind of work? What's in your background that drew you to this community support role?
I'm originally a product of West Auckland, actually. I don't hold against me, but it's my one blight or one blemish in my record. But actually, you know, I was raised out West Auckland, and I happened to attend church. So obviously, I was brought up in a strong traditional Samoan upbringing, and church was quite an integral part of that. But and it was through there that, you know, that real spirit of service and learning to help one another was actually fostered. And I was quite privileged enough to attend university where I studied law. And from there, I always wanted to follow, I guess, a social justice pathway, which led me to the Māngere Community Law Centre. And my current role here is basically working as a community advocate and teaching legal education. So that was the pathway to South Auckland. I got married, and my wife and I were privileged enough to purchase a house out here as well in Māngere. So Māngere is home now, and that's South Auckland for us now. So it's quite a privilege to, serve this community and, more importantly, live here and be a part of the actual fabric. So, yeah.
Oh, fantastic. And maybe for listeners, do you want to just expand a little bit on social justice, what that actually means?
A range of things are actually social justice. It's just utilising our position. So it doesn't necessarily have to be legal. It could be in whatever field, but there's always been a focus that we're using our skills, our knowledge, and applying them to benefit our society as a whole. So a lot of people undertake areas to address the social inequities, areas such as criminal law, where there's a large imbalance in terms of resources for those who can't defend themselves, or even in areas of family law where our community might need assistance in adoption or parenting orders, or even in matters of migration. So, in the term social justice mentioned, basically using your skills and your ability to help our community, often those who are disadvantaged. But, social justice in a nutshell.
Fantastic. So you're using that that concept is kind of driving your activity in a range of ways. So can you tell us a little bit about what a community law centre is and what the Māngere Community Law Centre is doing in this kind of dimension?
Yeah, so just a little bit about our community law centre. Our community law centre was established in 1986, and some prominent foundational members left their relatively well-established jobs in the city and found a conviction to come and serve in the Māngere community. And it was just set up as a one-off clinic outside of David Longy's office at the time. And the outpouring was, the demand was so huge that they left their jobs and they founded the Māngere Community Law Centre. And from there, our law centre has basically just focused on meeting the unmet legal needs of our community. So that's a range of things. So we come across everything from housing to helping people with immigration matters and also family matters. So at the community law centre, we provide free legal clinics for matters such as family law. So that's everything from adoptions, parenting orders and domestic violence to things such as immigration and consumer clinics. We've got a good working relationship with Russell McVay where they come in and offer their services free of charge to our community at large. So basically this is a hub or a service that can address the legal needs of our community.
So you're getting a really broad kind of experience of day-to-day life out in the South from your role there. But you've also undertaken the administrative kind of support role for the Ngā Maunga Network in Māngere. So can you tell us a little bit about what that is and what that entails?
Yeah, sure. I'll be quite privileged just to add to the legacy of Ngā Maunga. So Ngā Maunga or Māngere is the branches of Māngere. And it started basically as a group in 1991, composition of social workers and just those who cared for the community. This meeting's a bi-monthly meeting that is open to the community at large, whether you're a social practitioner or you're a professional, even you're just a local resident who's concerned about Māngere. So we just have thematic issues that address what's going on in our community. Everything from housing, health, education, welfare. We try and get our best experts to come on through and just let our community discuss these issues, discuss possible solutions and just build that network and fellowship amongst everybody who lives in our respective communities. So basically just a glorified administrator. So we have no actual secretary, but I've just taken it upon myself to just keep everyone informed in terms of when these meetings take place, because I guess that's the beauty of it. It's been running for a couple of decades now, but it's so organic in the sense that I think the steering committee were at pains whether to formalise the actual structure, but it's the beauty of community, is that we can congregate. We're able to provide a follow-up structure, but there's a real heart for our community out here. So if you live in our area or you work in our area, which is Māngere, we're more than welcome to attend our Ngā Maunga community meeting, and hopefully we look forward to working alongside our listeners this afternoon.
Absolutely. And it's really interesting to me. So we're sort of thinking a little bit about issues and about community action to address issues, and I think Ngā Maunga is extraordinary, and as you say, it's kind of an organic, informal grouping which is actually very large and has sustained itself over several decades. But I guess people such as yourself do feel called to step forward in one way or another from time to time to keep that moving. It's quite, what do you think, do you have any feeling about why it's so successful? Because so many of these groups fall over once a key person moves away, or it's just too much for people and they burn out, you know?
Yeah, I think that there's a beauty of beauty and challenges, as you've pointed out. So a lot of these organisations or movements really fail to implement any form of succession or any form of building capability and competency for the next kind of leaders to come on through. So I was quite privileged. I've only been involved for the past 2 years or so, but our steering committee are quite open in the sense of not exclusive. So they wanted to identify local talent. So our current facilitator and convener is Andrew Tawai, it was Swiss Drive Community Trust, and myself, Sergeant Stewart, but our steering committee, Community Thoughts, who are wanting to invest in us, knowing that they don't always want to be at the forefront of this meeting, but they want to prepare the next generation. And if we follow that kind of mindset and always prepare and know that Nāmanga is always bigger than an individual or a particular organisation, you know, we'll stand the test of time, provided that we mentor and we nurture the next facilitators and conveners. So, that's, I guess, the success of Nāmanga. And it was purely, I think, because everyone saw the genuine heart of this meeting. There's no real hidden agendas or there's no pretentious kind of messaging that's come across. It's people who acknowledge that, yes, we wear professional hats, but we all have a heart for this respective community. And irrespective of our professional boundaries and scopes, we're all mature enough to come to the table and, I guess, conversate and have that dialogue to see what's in the best interest of our community at large. So, yeah, that's, I guess, the beauty and the strength and explains the longevity, if I may.
Yeah, and I find that fascinating because there's a real thoughtful investment of time and support for, as you say, modernly people would say, I guess, succession planning, but for the next generation to foster leadership skills in the community around you, not to necessarily be front and centre. But so not only is the activity, the discussion and action plans that might come from the discussion, but it's also in nurturing people in the way that the group operates and allowing them to take the roles that they're able to take to carry certain things forward. Really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. One of those things that I acknowledge, I guess, like Peter Sykes, the likes of Peter Sykes, Grace, you are even Ida Tupaya, just investing and being able to look into the next generation. And I'm saying so because I know Otahu is very close to your heart. obviously we've got the similar Otahu community network meeting, which is run by Shabna Nisha.
That's right.
At the lower town hall in Otahu. So we always try and work alongside our colleagues because, you know, we're one electorate, but we support we won't call them our younger sibling, but obviously our sister network over there in Otahu as well.
Thank you for that. Really appreciate it. And, of course, there's the Otara Network Action Committee as well that meets. So there are a number of these small groupings. And I guess across all of this is the SANE, or the South Auckland Youth Network, which is another sort of network of providers mainly, or teachers or people involved with young people who also meet on a regular basis to consider various issues. And I think against this, so we have this enormous goodwill, we have very professional people in the community, we have community activists, and then we have this kind of background of what appears to be growing unrest again. So I'm wondering, I guess, several things. I'll sort of fire a couple of things at you and get your responses. So firstly, do you think that this media perception of growing unrest is correct? I mean, I was talking to the community constable in Otara only this morning, who tells me that actually the crime rate in Otara is extremely low, for example. But do you think the media perceptions of growing unrest are correct, and that our young people are more at risk at the moment than they have been? And then how do you see these community groups stepping up to kind of address those issues? And I know you've recently attended a symposium along this line. So do you want to just sort of throw out some thoughts about those two things?
Yeah, just a couple of reflections. I'm inclined to, I'm not a community constable, but I'm more inclined to support his view. And, you know, obviously the media's got a job, and they're obviously stories that draw headlines or clickbait, you know, sell. So we're not going to hear stories about, you know, do good, feel good kind of narratives. We're always going to be, hearing stories that will, it builds on that stereotype, or it almost perpetuates the notion that South Auckland is, you know, a hub of crime and so on and so forth. So, but then, you know, you can't discount the role of technology nowadays, where things are just recorded on your phones and uploaded. So I'm inclined to disagree with how the media portrays South Auckland in terms of the rates, the constable has said. And maybe it's just because we've got so much access to technology nowadays and so much access to, you know, I mean, you can ask anybody who's grown up in South Africa, these issues aren't new. It's not a spike in crime. It's just that we've got more access to information, and therefore it appears as if though we've, you know, got an influx or, you know, there's crime unrest. Mm. But these have been common issues that have been faced. You speak to any youth worker or social worker, they'll let you know, look, these are just issues that have been, I guess, unfortunately intergenerational. Mm. But, you know, as we've got more media outlets or more information coming to the average user via cell phone or any social medium, it appears as though it's disproportionately growing. But, yeah, I'm more inclined to disagree.
And so with these and I guess there are sort of drivers underlying the issues that low socioeconomic communities experience, but do you think that the role of kind of the volunteers and the provider networks and so forth are sufficient to address what's going on in the communities at the moment?
It's a big
question, sorry.
Yeah, it's a huge question. I really take off my hat to the volunteer sector and the community sector. And I acknowledge the absolutely incredible and essential work that they do, but they've often shouldered the burden for what the state should essentially be funding and and providing assistance with. But it's a collective approach. We can't, not one party shares the load in terms of addressing these social drivers, many of which can be addressed on a macro state level, and many which can be, I guess, mitigated or supported by various faith-based institutions, which I believe is a sleeping giant here in South Auckland, where we have our churches actually taking more responsibility, investing more in these groups to assist their parishioners or their practitioners and so on and so forth. So, in saying so, yeah, I believe that volunteers have a huge part to play, but that burden shouldn't be just shouldered by themselves, and they should be provided the necessary resources by the state or the private sector or whoever. And I'm not just talking about financial resources. We spoke about Ngāmanga and these organized, community-driven organizations that I guess lack the governance or the corporate side of things, where, you know, if the government can come in and teach sound governance practices and stuff. Because I think one thing I've noticed is that we've got wonderful operational staff, frontline staff, but the higher we go up in the, you know, governance and organisational structures, then I guess the more there is opportunity to build capability within volunteer networks so they can have that long-term sustainability. So I guess that's a roundabout way of addressing and identifying challenges that community organisations face as well.
That's really interesting. So, so that there's a role for the state and possibly for private sector to build capacity in that regard. That's a really interesting thought. And obviously, we've got real issues, as will be known to our listeners and to you, that the local population is very, very young. In Mangere o Tahu alone, under 24 is 50% of the population, and about 75% of the population there is affiliates Māori or Pacifica. And traditionally, or in recent years, the achievements, so-called, I don't want to use the language of the previous state because it's very black and white and blaming and so forth, but just to say that they haven't received the support they should have received, particularly, I think, in health and education and in pathways into employment, I think. So there's a big role for the state there. Do you see the new wellbeing budget is beginning to shift any of these, or do you think that we're still just sort of trucking along as we were?
I was grateful in the approach. When we look at the process, even before a dollar was spent, because the previous process was it was contestable fund. Each ministry just has a go at the pot, see how it goes. So I'm grateful that this government sat around the table and identified collectively what they thought their priorities were and then invested. I agree in the intergenerational approach as well, investing not just for this next term, but, you know, long-term spending to, you know, truly address those respective intergenerational issues which have been around for a time. And I also appreciate the different kinds of measures, Treasury issued that living standards kind of framework, not just measuring things in GDP, but, you know, measuring these qualitative kind of indicators, how happy are we? So I agree in the process and stuff. But in terms of money doesn't necessarily resolve issues. You know, money does, no matter how much money you can throw at a problem, there's sometimes deep-seated, I guess, issues in which we have to resolve as a community. You and I are aware of how low incomes incredibly impact our households here, especially in Manili or Otahuhu. So poverty and income disparity is one of the fundamental issues that impact our people over here. And so when I was reading through the budget, a commitment to business, I guess business was the big loser out of this budget, for lack of a better term, but, previous administration invested a lot in business and invested a lot in creating jobs, or that trickle-down economy, economics just doesn't work, but we want to see our people having living wages so they can support their household in essence. And if we're not doing well in that space, then our parents are going to be having a hard time. Look, you mentioned it before. I was just looking at, when I presented at the SAN Network, I just examined a couple of key indicators, and education being one of them. Education and, I guess, more health, but education in our South Auckland area, comparing secondary schools to, and even primary schools to, you know, our counterparts in Central, as an incredible disparity, even for new students just leaving high school and stuff. So, you know, we've got problems on the income front, and we've got problems in the education system, you know, at a fundamental level. And if we're not going to address those two hand in hand, we're not even touching health as well, then we've got a really long road ahead. But I do commend the government in taking the first step, being bold enough to say, hey, look, we've got to do better, and this is our plan. I acknowledge that they invested something to the tune of just short of $2 billion in mental health, which I totally commend. But it's, you know, I'd like to see where exactly that's going to go. Otherwise, we're just going to throw money to these housing problems. We've got no real strategy in place to actually see. So they concluded the review at the end of last year, the mental health inquiry, in which they made most adoptions, or where they adopted most of the findings. But we've got to be better in terms of having a strategic plan. Where are we going to invest this $1.9 billion, and what are the actual outcomes for our people? So there's a quiet optimism, but there's a long way to go. But I do commend the current government and its administration for taking that step first and foremost, to be bold enough to take a different approach and hopefully address these drivers that consistently produce these intergenerational problems.
So the devil is really going to be in the detail in terms of the investment. And and I guess we're actually just running out of time, and I sort of just wanted to briefly raise, of course, and then there are the cultural shifts, I think, that we all acknowledge are required, and the institutional racism at many levels that's still impacting not only our own Pacific communities but other migrant communities in New Zealand. And we've had that brought to confront us very graphically since, of course, the issues and since the events in Christchurch in March.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but I think we don't have time to go into that now, but I guess, I don't know how you feel, but for myself, I do come back to the enormous love and connection in the communities and the work that people do just in their daily lives for their neighbours, and that gives me hope, I think, that we're going to overcome these
things. Yeah, absolutely. I guess just in wrapping it, it's this idea of obviously volunteer week. I just want to close. I was attending a meeting, I can't recall, but I remember Peter Sykes saying, look, I guess time for communities to perhaps stop looking to the state for answers, but realising the trauma that the community possess, that we've got in our kite, and it's in that kite that we can resolve our own problems, resolve our own issues and challenges. So I guess, perhaps if the bigger institutions aren't going to, you know, pay attention, then it's on really us, the community, the volunteer sector, to show a better way. I guess this government's taking steps in the right direction, but I think, you know, the community grassroots level, man, this is where the innovation happens. This is where we can show systemic change, whether it be a volunteer organisation or a real small organisation. And it's through that micro change that we can make a better impact in the community at large.
Oh, absolutely. Look, thank you so much, and thank you for your contribution to this work on so many levels, both professionally and voluntarily, and of course moving to Māori and putting everything into one kite at the moment. So I've just
still trying to buy the Big Wednesday tonight, so I'll be here tomorrow night, so
absolutely. I've just got a couple of notices, and, you know, speaking of things that are happening in South Auckland, there is just so much going on that's hopeful and joyous. it's Matariki. We're moving into Matariki, which is a time of renewal and new growth. So this year's festival, the council festival from that perspective, is running from the 22nd of June, from Saturday through to the 14th of July. And there are more than 100 events and programs to allow people to experience Te Ao Māori in your libraries, in your parks and so on. But people who are interested might particularly be interested in two discussions that are going on the council website, and one of them is the Māori economy, and the other one is a council project which is dear to the Māori o Tahu local board heart, which is bringing Māori names and narratives into Auckland's parks and public spaces. So that's a fascinating piece of work, and I encourage people to follow along with that. On another note, the local board grants rounds, there is one last grant round that you can apply for that will pay out before Christmas of this year. So if you have a project that aligns with the local board priorities, it might be eligible for assistance, and you need to apply before the 26th of July. You can get the details on your local board's webpage, Facebook page, or call 301 0101. And on the arts side, things are going hard and fast, I must say. So the Rep Your Beats competition 2019, it's in its fourth year, when young beat makers from all over the country submit to Rep FM, which is a little radio station in Māori East. And the seven finalists plus last year's winner are going to go head to head at the end of June at the Māori Arts Centre, and that's always an amazing time to see these young people and the wonderful talents that they are bringing to bear. The Pacific Dance Festival is still going on, so it's got dual performances at Auckland Central and at the Māori Arts Centre until Sunday. And Cinderella. So for those of you who don't know, every April school holidays, South Auckland school children, and particularly in Māori o Tahu, are involved in producing a musical production. So essentially a pantomime. And for 2 years it's award-winning, and they're hugely talented. They write it, they direct it, they perform it. And for the second year in a row, Cinderella, this year's performance, has been invited into the Q Theatre in Queen Street. So that will be running from the 9th to the 13th of July, if anybody wants to get in there and support our locals as they take it to town. Now, more good news. Good coffee is coming in Otara, everybody. So Affirming Works, which is a fantastic social enterprise that runs coffee bars and imports Tongan coffee and products from Tonga, and uses the proceeds to mentor young Pacific leaders in South Auckland, are opening two cafes in Otara. So on Friday, they'll be opening one behind the Fresh Gallery in the town centre, and another at Te Puke o Tara, the big community centre up by the swimming pool. In Otahu, you will be aware that the Tonga team is in town. The game is on Saturday, and we've already had quite a number of processions in the last few days, but I have heard that there may be road closures, MMT whanau, around the town centre this weekend. So Otahu Main Street is likely to be closed on Saturday night. And lastly, the upgrade to the Otahu Town Centre. So there's a $17.4 million project to upgrade the town centre in Otahu, which has been somewhat delayed, but the next phase of the project delivery is going to start in August. So we will see improvements on Station Road, Great South Road and Mason Avenue, and it will be delivered in stages, so that's going to cause the least disruption to locals and local businesses. And the people who are winning the contract have undertaken to have an information office on the main street. So in fact, you will be able to just pop in there, drop by, see what's happening and get the latest information. There's also, the local board has been hounding them to start putting out a regular newsletter about what's happening, and that is about to start as well, so you'll be able to subscribe to that. So lots of good things happening alongside everything else, and I just want to say once again thank you so much, Harry. Harry Toliafoe from the Māori Arts Centre, and hope the rest of your year goes well.
Thank you very much, Christine. And keep up the hard work at local board, and once again just want to acknowledge all our volunteers this weekend, and all the best for MMT, as well as for Samoa, taking on this weekend.
I should have actually said, of course, that the Samoan women will be at the Māngere Town Centre on Saturday, so fans can go down there and meet them. All right. Thank you very much, and have a great week.
All right, Christine. Yeah.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Get together next week at 9.05 a.m. or listen online anytime on planetaudio.org.nz/RedAlertRadio.